You're listening to the Sound Atlas.
Hey, welcome back to another episode. I am your host, Captain Dean, on location at Mellow Matt's Music and More, where we just received word that Neil Peart, the greatest drummer of all time, has died. And that is very weird to get that news right before I started recording, because my guest is a drummer who happens to be a really big fan of Rush.
Oh, yeah.
So this will be an interesting moment to discuss drumming and all that fun stuff.
Sure.
But when you are not in Frankfurt...
I'm not in Frankfurt anymore.
Are you not in Russia?
No. I'm retired from politics.
See, why did I not know? I totally did my homework.
Yeah, and this is not Jody Richards.
Well, he used to be in Frankfurt doing work for the state in his district. He is also well known to being spotted behind his custom-built Jimmy Lewis drums.
Sure, occasionally.
Quite the drummer you are, Mr. Jim DeCesare. Welcome to the Sound Atlas.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with another quite the drummer. So, the Lewis kid, I love it. It's
you've had several drums since I've met you. You've had lots of different things, but... You're very loyal to playing stuff that Jimmy custom builds.
Well, I have that one kit by him, and we'll just get started there. I wanted something that sort of emulated a Buddy Rich kit. I wanted a white Marine Pearl kit.
White Marine Pearl, yeah.
And so Jimmy Lewis was gracious enough to do one up for me, mm-hmm. and I actually play that kit a lot. Personally, I don't play it out in public much anymore.
Right.
I also have a Gretsch New Classic that I got in 2006. I
believe that's the one I saw you with on recently.
Yeah, that's the one I typically am playing out in public. But I also have a 1964 Ludwig Club Kit.
Nice.
With an 18-inch kick that I keep at the house that I truly love. And it's probably... the Gretsch really sounds good, but that
it's that great Gretsch sound.
Yeah, but that little Ludwig, man, it's awesome.
There's something weird about the Chicago drums from that era, Leedy, Ludwig, and Slingerland.
Yep.
There was a certain tone in those shells, the way that they did the reinforcing hoops, and there was just something about them.
And I have a Slingerland story I can tell you later, too.
Well, let's get into it.
Well, and let me go through my arsenal of equipment. I also, 2 years ago, someone posted on the WKE Classifieds a Yamaha Stage Custom, a five-piece. You know, it's a nice little kit.
Yep.
And I was able to get it at a steal. So I have that set up at the house. So I have actual acoustic kits, and then I have one electronic kit that I just tinker around on here and there. So that's my arsenal.
That's your arsenal.
And, of course, I use Zildjian cymbals and hardware. I don't care. As long as it's double brace and it'll stand up to the beating I'm going to give.
There's a lot of good brands out there
that are
known for hardware, even though they're drum companies. But, like, Gibraltar is a hardware company.
And Gibraltar. I use a lot of Pearl hardware. I really like the Pearl hardware.
I am with you on that.
And
I've always owned different brands of drums, but I've always used Pearl hardware for the most part. I have Drum Workshop stands and pedals, but also have Pearl, like, cymbal stands and tom mounts. And I'm with you on that.
So, you know, just as long as typically I need it to be double braced, mm-hmm. and that can stand the test of time.
Yes, it must take a beating. Well, Jim,
but let me tell you about my Slingerland kit.
Oh, tell
me
about the Slingerland kit.
So, you ask your question, because I think it'll fit in a timeline of the things that you want
to
say.
We'll get to that.
Yeah, okay.
Well, the first question is always, Mr. DeCesare, where are you from?
I was born in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Oh, okay.
My mother lived on Madeira Beach.
Nice.
My mother and father, when I was born, we lived on Madeira Beach. When I was about 3.5 years old, when my mother was pregnant with my brother, Todd, who still lives in Florida, my father left.
Oh.
And so Todd and I were raised by my mom.
Okay.
Two rambunctious boys raised by a single lady, and we split
in
time.
Florida.
and Kentucky. My mother was originally from Kentucky.
Oh, she was.
So we split time, literally from the time I was born until I finished high school, between Hopkinsville, Kentucky, and Clearwater, Florida.
Oh, wow!
So we moved back and forth several times. She was a nurse for the most part, And when times got hard,
opening was is where you ended up.
If times were good, we were in Florida. If times got bad, she was near her family.
There you go.
You know, and when she died in 06, she's buried in Hopkinsville. She's actually buried right next to her father. Mm. So I go over and visit her every now and then when I get through that part.
So
of the
Hopkinsville
state.
Roots.
Hopkinsville
for you.
Roots. My wife, of course, is Amy, mm-hmm. and she's from. Originally born in Bowling Green, but she grew up in Todd County.
Okay.
We actually met in Hopkinsville. You ask where I'm from, so that kind of tells you that. But I spent the first 20 years of my professional life in radio. Yeah. I was a broadcaster, program director, and operations manager. So
is that coming out of high school or
not right out of high school? I was a club DJ.
Oh, you did a lot.
I mobile DJ'd. Music has always been extremely
important. Well, that was my next
question.
Is how did music enter your life, and was it from the standpoint of being a fan of it, or did you become a fan of music and have the knack of wanting to play and discovering that you had the talent to?
Well, my mother was a fan of music. She moved to Florida when she was 18, but as a kid, she used to go to the Grand Ole Opry.
Oh, wow.
In the 50s.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
She get to see.
And so when she was 18, she had an aunt that lived down there in Florida, and she moved to Florida. Hmm. And she became an airline stewardess for Eastern Airlines.
Wow.
And so she had the Miami to New York route.
Mm-hmm.
And so she got to meet a lot of famous people. And actually, I have she has it. I have it now. A program from Herman's Hermits, and the band that was opening for them was The Who, and they
Get
were on her
here.
Flight, so they all signed it. I have that.
You have that?
Yeah, I have a picture of her and Gene Krupa together at the Metropole Club in New York City. It
That's
is so
amazing.
Cool. Yeah, and she actually her roommate at one time was a movie extra on an Elvis movie, and she mm-hmm. actually got to go to the casting party and played cards with Elvis once,
great.
And I remember when he died, she bawled like a baby, kind of like I'm bawling today over here,
What an interesting way to begin this podcast with that news. I mean, it literally just came to me.
Yeah, I found out about
right
an hour
before
ago.
We started, yeah.
And so my mom was a big Motown fan, though.
Okay.
So when I was a kid, she always had Motown playing on the stereo, and so, I'm a big fan of that sound. But then as I got older, and, you're influenced by the people you hang out with.
All right.
And I was telling this story. I was talking to actually when I pulled in, I was talking to Eric Self on the phone. And
and Eric's like, oh, I did one. It's cool.
Yeah, yeah. And I was telling him, I remember the first time listening to Rush.
Mm-hmm.
I was like in fourth grade in 1975 or whatever.
Okay, yeah.
And my buddy Buzz Chambers over in Hopkinsville, he had a Fly By Night album.
Oh,
and we're sitting in his bedroom listening to that and a Cheech and Chong album. The High Heel Sneaker song, So, that was my first introduction to Rush, but, and I was a huge Kiss fan. Mm-hmm. I mean, like most kids of
right.
my
era. You grew up in the era of where 60s rock and roll, Motown and 60s rock and roll, you got to witness this, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, you were alive and well.
Sure.
During the heyday of when all of that kicked off.
Oh, yeah. I was there when, I wasn't there, but, I grew
Television
up.
Brought it to you, though.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Did
I mean,
you get to see... The normal stuff that everyone always refers to, the Beatles and
no,
Jimi Hendrix
I'm not that
and the
old.
Stones. because I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm 53, but, I remember...
more of a 70s.
More 70s,
okay.
Yeah. Born in the 60s. That's okay.
well, if you were born in the 60s, you clearly remember the Beatles.
Sure. I remember the Beatles, and it's funny about the Beatles is I really never became a fan till later in life.
Yeah.
Learned to appreciate them.
Yeah, I think because it was such a short thing. If you weren't alive between 64 and 69, then we all discovered it later in life.
I mean, when I was with Skip Bond and Fugees, we were together twice as long as the Beatles, you put it into perspective.
Yeah,
like
it's a trip. 9 years? I mean, that's crazy to think about. It's not even 9 years. It's like, what is it, 6, 7 years?
Yeah,
it's a very short
minimal,
very short time.
But,
because I guess some people tack on the early years for them of like 62, 63. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's give or take about a decade.
You know, Wicked, Lester, and Kiss. I mean, you don't count those years, you know.
True. The hardcore fans.
But, you know, when in the 70s when I was listening to music, I remember listening to like one of my bucket list bands to see before he died was Steve Miller Band. I finally got to see him a couple years ago.
Still, yeah, it was good.
You know, I loved his music in the 70s. Of course, there was the disco era.
Yeah.
There was Kiss, but there was Styx. You know, talk about a phenomenal drummer, mm-hmm. you know, for Styx. And now Todd Zukerman's their drummer, and I'm a huge fan of his.
I got to see them a few summers ago, and my dear friend John is the drum tech for REO Speedwagon.
Yeah, I saw that picture of you sitting behind the kit. Yeah,
we were at Disney.
Yeah.
And I was sitting by the pool on vacation, and I heard REO Speedwagon and Styx are going to be in Tampa and Jacksonville. And I called John. I said, hey, I'm in Florida. Can I come see you in Tampa or Jacksonville? He's like, come see me in Jacksonville.
That's a little farther drive from Orlando, though.
Well, we were on our way up to Savannah.
Oh, okay.
So it worked out perfect.
Yeah.
And so we went up and we got to see that show. And it was REO Speedwagon and Styx, but also the guy that was in the Eagles.
Oh, yeah.
I always forget his name, but he did heavy metal.
Yeah.
Of course, I forget his name because of the interview.
Yeah.
But it was awesome. And I got to see Todd and his amazing drum kit. Like, I was 5 feet from it.
Yeah.
You know, it was really incredible to watch.
That's awesome.
But I know what you mean.
So, you know, I mean, I had a lot. I listened to a lot of different things as a kid.
But you grew up in a really great time.
Oh, yeah. High school. You know, I 80 to 84, I was in high school. You know, some great music. My first concert ever.
Can't wait to hear this.
And it wasn't my first concert by choice. It just happened. It was an opportunity, and I went at the Bayfront Center in St. Petersburg, Florida. I saw the Outlaws of Blackfoot.
Oh.
It was my first concert.
Wow.
So Greengrass and High Tides.
Yeah.
Train.
That's not bad, though. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it's cool.
Could have been worse.
And from there, you know, I mean, a ton of shows.
Yeah.
You know, I'm looking at a poster of the Police here. You know, mm-hmm. Stuart Copeland is.
You got to see a lot of good stuff.
Yeah. I'm a huge fan of Stuart Copeland as a drummer for Police. But mm-hmm. then, you look at his body of work since then as a composer.
Oh, it's incredible.
You know.
The soundtrack work.
He's done.
Like the stuff of the African, you know, tribal music and all of that stuff. But it's incorporated with full drum kit.
Yeah.
And just his way of composing. Like it fits everything I've ever seen his work on as far as like television shows and nature shows and stuff.
Sure.
Like, it's really remarkable.
And you know, so I saw them on the Ghost in the Machine tour. Mm. I saw Van Halen when I was in high school on the Diver Down tour. You know, I like Alex Van Halen. I think he's a great drummer. You know, I think you know, just a lot of different
influences.
A lot
of peak times for a lot of great music.
Sure.
And the guys like me that got to see great stuff in the 90s didn't get to see it in the 80s.
See, in the 90s, I was still seeing the 80s. In the 70s, I saw the Eagles in the 90s. You know?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's true. A lot of good stuff still surfaced or came back around.
And, you know, you asked me about, you know, drummers today. You know, I lost.
I stopped reading Modern Drummer over 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I just don't keep up with it anymore because it became so saturated with like ripoffs of this, that, and the other, and some of those bands didn't last very long. So I don't know. It was just an odd thing to follow, but I just kind of lost touch with that world. But it's a cool thing to be a part of, I guess, during the time of when you're alive and everything.
I was a big in high school. I listened to, you know, I liked everything, but I liked prog rock.
Mm-hmm.
I was a huge Asia fan.
Oh, okay.
They came to Franklin, Tennessee a few years ago and played. I mean, it was really cool.
Where was that at? Like the factory or something?
No, it was at the Franklin Theater, like their version of the Capitol Arts.
Yeah.
And so, I got to meet, I did the meet and greet and got to hang out with the band. And so, you know, now I'm drawing a blank. One of the top 10 drummers of all time, you know.
That guy.
Carl Palmer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know.
I forget that he's in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, and he plays traditional grip.
Yes,
and
he does.
And plays a double, but, you know, sort of like Todd Sukerman, mm-hmm. their traditional drip.
Do you remember that Paiste drum kit that he had? Mm-hmm. The whole kit was built out of Paiste cymbals. Yeah. And, like, the bass drum weighed, like, 80 pounds.
And I think he's exclusive with Ludwig now.
Yeah, but, well, he's always been... Yeah, pretty back and forth with them.
But
well, speaking of drumming, when did drumming come into your life? Is that the only instrument that you play, or what's your music?
Yeah,
history?
I mean, technically, yes. So in middle school in Hopkinsville Middle School in seventh grade, you could join the band,
mm-hmm.
and I joined the band in seventh grade as a sax player.
Okay.
And by the end of the first semester, you know, by Christmas break, I was done with the sax. And the reason I played sax is because Boots Randolph was from Western Kentucky.
Yeah.
You know, legendary saxophone player.
Absolutely.
My mom loved him. You know, she's like, you need to play the sax. I'm like, all right. You know, and I enjoyed the sax. I mean, don't get me wrong. And I think if I had stuck with the sax, I'd probably have been a better sax player than I am a drummer. You know, but I wanted to be a drummer.
Yeah.
You know, and so
that's always the part of it that gets. Yeah.
Yeah. So when I came back from Christmas break, I went back to the band director and I said, I don't want to play sax. I want to play drums.
Yeah.
So, you know, I went down to the music store and at Central Music, which is still around.
It was still there.
Yeah.
Wow.
I went to
Central
Music.
I didn't realize it was that.
It's
long
that
ago.
Old. And you got a snare case right next to you, similar to that, except it was the hard rubber case, mm-hmm. you know. Got my little Ludwig snare, you know, the beginner snare.
Yeah.
And,
the student
model. Started there.
Yeah.
And, but I struggled because I'm left handed.
Ah, now see, I don't talk to many left-handed drummers.
I'm not a left-handed drummer.
Well, I know that, but yeah. I mean, as a left-handed person,
yeah.
Do you play the hi-hat with your left
no,
hand?
No, I use my right.
Okay,
so interesting. So, but it was a challenge trying to learn drums in middle and high school. I marched in band all 4 years of high
because
school.
Because the books are written,
it's all
right, left, yeah. left, right, and so your dominant hand's going to go first. So did you have to take those exercises and reverse?
No.
Because you stuck to it.
Because when you're in a school band, and for instance, in eighth grade,
mm-hmm.
you know, I remember coming to Western Kentucky University, going to Ivan Wilson Fine Arts Center, and doing a drum solo.
Oh yeah,
snare, you know, a piece for my level, and it had to be. The sticking had to be right,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, I got a good score. But then when you get into marching band, and by that time we were back in Florida, and, you know, marching band in Florida was very competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, my drum instructor and my band director were also the instructors for the Corps, which was Suncoast Sound down in that area.
Oh, wow.
And so when you're in a marching band, everybody's got to be the same.
Yeah.
You know, so,
I mean, it's precision.
Yeah.
It's really remarkable to watch.
But, you know, I also learned a lot too, because now when I play a kit, because I also started playing a kit in high school in the jazz.
I was
going to
say, did you ever like experiment, join a garage band or anything like that?
Not really. We had one band, and I lived in an apartment, and I met some other guys that live in another apartment complex, and we started a band. And the bass player, the only thing he could play was Rick Springfield. So that's all we played was Rick Spring. We were the Rick Springfield cover band.
Oh, wow.
Which was funny because about, you know, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years later, I saw him. I went to a club one night, and he was in a hair band, and I mean, he was he was throwing it down. I mean, he was, you know, doing all the, you know, the white and the Cinderella stuff.
Wow.
And, you know,
so they were
playing
home
all,
with
yeah
that.
Yeah, and, you know, had the spandex on, and so, you know, I called him during break and I go, what? No Rick Springfield? I mean, I thought he's going to die laughing because, I mean, that...
Yeah, you know? That song, I mean, it was mega.
Oh, it's huge.
Huge. I mean, not with
and then he was
radio, but that's
too.
When MTV's yeah. coming of age, and you couldn't go anywhere without hearing that song.
No, you know, and when I was in high school, that's when MTV came out.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you got home from school, that's what you turned on, and mm-hmm. So Asia, you know, I mentioned them earlier. They were an MTV band. Mm-hmm. You know, they were huge on MTV. Yep. You know, like Pat Benatar, and I loved watching her videos because she had that crazy wild drummer that had the white kit with the Japanese symbols on it. You know, so you know, played jazz band, did well. Learned, that's when I first started playing the kit some, and then I got away from drumming for about 20 years.
20 years. Mm-hmm. So you got into,
I got
you
into
stayed
radio.
In the music world, but you got into like
I didn't play.
DJing and
Being on the radio, doing morning shows.
So how did you get into that? Did you do the course through college kind of thing?
No. So backing up to when I was a kid, mm-hmm. when I was, you know, playing in high school or middle school bands, I always wanted to be on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'd set up my stereo in my room and I'd have my...
kind of like what I have here
my 45s and WJIM radio was on the air.
There you go.
And so when I got out of high school, I didn't go to college. I actually dropped out of high school, mm-hmm. and I got there was an ad in a paper for mobile DJ called Sunshine
Mobile DJ,
yeah, something like that, down in St. Petersburg, and so I called this guy up, and he hired me, and it was a nice operation. They provide the equipment, you go out and do the job, and you get, you know, 50% of whatever's made. You know,
I mean,
and
that's the work.
I drove all over Florida playing bar mitzvahs, weddings.
In a state filled with beaches and,
you know,
vacation getaways and all the resorts.
And I did stuff everywhere. And then, you know, any tips I got, that was extra.
Yeah.
You know, I you know, back in the 80s, you know, you play a bar mitzvah and they're, you know, at 10 o'clock you're supposed to be done. They're going, well, we want you to play one more hour. We'll give you $200. I'm like, sure. You know. And then eventually I started doing some club DJing, and so I met a guy that was on the radio in Florida. He was on the an adult contemporary station, back in
the VH1 of the 80s.
Yeah, you know, the radio stations
Don Henley and
Phil
Collins.
You had Top 40, you had Country, you had AC, and you had AOR, which was the rock stations.
Yeah.
And he was on an AC station, great guy. He actually wrote a little book on how to be a DJ, and he actually mentions me in it. And he let me come to the studios at night and watch him. And I'd go into the production studio, and I would do mock radio shows. Mm-hmm. And he would critique me and help me, and I put a demo tape together. And so it's not, you know, it's not what you know, it's who you know.
Right.
And
no, I believe that.
It is.
I think being in radio is no different than being a musician.
In anything, yeah.
Yeah. If you're good at it and someone sees the potential and knows that you're going to be reliable, why wouldn't they hire you than some schmuck that comes out of school with a degree in it?
Yeah. So
that they're all schmucks, by the way.
But, you know, using the who you know, my family in Hopkinsville, they knew the people that owned the rock radio station there, and I got hired, and that's how I started a 20-year career in radio.
So you
and that's
come,
where I met
and that's how you come back to Kentucky.
Yeah, and then I moved around on the radio. I mean, I went back to Florida for a while.
Did.
I worked for the Home Shopping Network.
I've literally been back and forth from Kentucky to Florida.
I've been in Bowling Green since 92, though.
Okay.
So this is the longest.
The longest.
I've lived here for...
You still go to Florida for vacation, right?
Occasionally. You know, it's not the
obviously
same.
Obviously, your brother's down there.
Yeah,
right?
He's down there. He came home for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but the constant in all of that is music,
mm-hmm.
you know. And drums,
right.
Whether I had a kid or
so
not.
So it's not that you were playing or in bands, but you still had drums, you still would play records and tap along.
Yeah, tap along, you know, air drum. Yeah, you know.
Whether you didn't follow that rhythm, as an actual thing to do.
And my last kit was a Slingerland kit that I wish I still had. If you go to Kentucky Music, I think Dave's got one
still
up there on the top.
It,
and it's like one of those. Mm-hmm. It's old 60s, you know, club kit. And I was a big fan of the Outfield. Loved the Outfield.
That's crazy.
Oh, man. I thought they were great. And I'd, you know, put on their record and throw some headphones on and play along with the Outfield record. Same with Loverboy. Mm-hmm. Love Loverboy. You know, because I'm not a great drummer. I mean, you know.
I wouldn't say that. I've seen you.
Well, I'm a...
You're a solid drummer. It's not that you're flashy.
That. Yeah, I'm not flashy.
You don't get up there and do drum solos.
You know, I'll drop a stick.
I mean, there's
too.
Been multiple times I have seen you more at, like, Concert in the Park.
Right.
You know, because your bands are known for playing...
Yeah, we do
the,
weddings.
The family and, yeah. events and the more open
corporate
public
events.
Thing. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Stuff like
because
that.
Because the music... the set list and everything you all always had was more of that.
Songs you know.
Yeah, exactly. And there's so many times I would come to those things and you'd see me. You'd be like, hey, how's it going? We'd talk and you're just like, eh, you know, and I'd sit on the side of the stage and just watch you play. And I've seen you multiple times over the years. I mean, you're, in my eyes, you're a fantastic drummer.
Well, thank you. I
you're
appreciate
solid.
That.
You're on the beat. You play for the song.
Yeah.
You don't do anything stupid. You don't stand up and kick the cymbals and jump down on them and do all that crap. I mean, you sit down and play the song.
Well, I appreciate that. That's quite a compliment.
And, it's true.
And you know, I think of myself as a solid drummer, just mm-hmm. a, you know, a 2/4 backbeat drummer. And that's okay. I'm good with that.
No, it's, to me, that's the job.
Yeah.
It took me a long time to learn the difference of being a stupid kid and having fun and making noise and being an actual involved part of a band. Like, your job is to keep time.
Yeah.
And to do it well. And you can throw in fills and
sure.
fancy licks, and nobody gives a damn, you know? But the
you,
musicians
you think about
might
the greatest
you.
Drum fills you know yeah. ever. There's nothing fancy to them.
Nothing fancy. It's just cool. And it works for the song. So yeah. I learned much, much later in life to play for the song.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did.
And you know, I think, you know, that's a coming from you, it's a great compliment to me. And, you know, the greatest compliments that I can get, I'll give you a perfect example. We were playing the Concert in the Park this year. And, you know, we play Mustangs. You know, everybody plays Mustangs.
Everybody plays it.
And, you know, when it does that break three times in a song, I'll throw the stick in the air like Neil Peart and catch it most of the time. But... it was a good, solid gig. We were having a good time. Tony Lindsay's crew was running mm-hmm. the sound. Yep. And we were in some song, and I saw Tyrone Dunn come up and talk to Tony on the side of the stage. And I waved. You know, I didn't wave to him, but I acknowledged him, because it's tough to wave when you're flinging drumsticks. But anyhow, I thought it was him because it was at dusk, and there was no lights over there.
Yeah.
And so when we took a break, I said, hey, Tony, I said, was that Tyrone? He said, yeah. I go, oh, cool. He goes, man. And this is what I consider the greatest comment. He goes, DeCesare's in the pocket. And whenever anyone says the drummer's in the pocket, it doesn't get any better.
That's home.
That's home. You know, that's if you're home, in the yeah. pocket, you are doing your job.
But you're playing songs, which I know, and we'll touch on the band names and all the stuff you've
sure.
done. But the songs that you guys play are...
it's not rocket some of science.
It's not rocket science, but you can mess it up.
Oh, sure.
And it's one of those things where it does take skill, and it does take knowledge to understand the difference of overplaying and playing in the pocket. And so, yes, that is a great compliment.
It is. And
but you're playing songs of classic American, for the most part. Maybe some British stuff.
Yeah, there might be.
There's a lot of, like, if you guys are still playing the old...
we're doing a lot of...
Muscle Shoals and the Detroit sound.
You know,
and
I got my Muscle Shoals
there
hat.
You go, see? And that's what I'm talking about. Those studio drummers, for the most part, or even the Wrecking Crew stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You're mimicking greats that played for the song and played in the pocket. So... you can't get on stage and screw that up, because then it's like it wouldn't be the same. So you have to basically honor that.
And I'll tell you a lesson I learned back in high school through my drum instructor is I was one of the first marching band drummers in the country to play, excuse me, the quads, you know, the four tenors.
Yeah.
The first year.
I love the sound of those things.
Yeah. You know, and my drum instructor, who was writing for Corps, and if you ever seen a drum and bugle corps, you know, DCI,
oh, yeah.
I mean,
it's amazing.
Are serious.
I've seen several shows at Western come through, and I mean.
Yeah, they used to have this was a yearly stop.
It was. Back in the they don't do 90s. It anymore.
Mm-mm. And So he would write the parts, you know, and I'm like, and I'm left-handed, you know, on top of that. And
you take them apart and rebuild them? Yeah.
So what he would do, you know, he would, and I was the first chair quad player. I
How mean, about
there was
that?
Two of us.
There you go.
And, you know, so I'm nowhere close. The other guy is totally lost, you know. And so what he taught me a lesson, though. My drum instructor taught me a lesson. Cut in half.
Mm-hmm.
You know, drumming and music in general is all about time.
Yep.
And so you can take the most complicated beat of any song and you can cut it in half. Whether it's a bass, playing bass or playing, you know, drums or whatever. I don't know much about guitar, but I do know about the rhythm section. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he would take those six tuplets and cut them down into 16th notes.
There you go.
I can go, you know, I can do 16th notes. I'm not doing six tuplets. I'm not there. And especially if you're leading with your right, you know, it's a train wreck from the get-go. So... the starting a left-handed paradiddle is my best friend for drum fills. Yeah. So if you ever watch me, you'll see me start.
I've never noticed that.
And usually it's a paradiddle to get me going.
Okay. Yeah.
You know.
I get that.
Once I get that going, then
I mean, if you mention that now, it makes sense. But I've never really.
You learned it. Yeah. Cheats, you know. I can't do the kick for walk this way.
Well, I think that's the thing about drumming is it is there are rules, so to speak. You know, there's written things about it,
yeah.
But everybody's different.
Yeah,
you can learn stuff, yeah. But you're never going to play it exactly like either the instructor or the musician you're watching as a fan.
There's only one guy that can play Tom Sawyer. The right
way. He's dead.
And he's no longer with us. But
terrifying.
We could try.
Yeah, I'm still like this whole time we keep bringing up Rush and it's like, it's weird.
Well, you know, I was thinking, you know, was Neil Peart an influence on me? No. And I'll explain why. Because I was never at that. I'm with you on that.
But I never looked at him and tried to mimic it.
Yeah, was he an inspiration? Absolutely.
Absolutely. Because of his determination, his work ethic is what's impressive.
Yeah, and his you know, he's knowledge of music.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
He was a composer as well.
He wrote the lyrics.
There's not many drummers that actually
can. No, he was a brilliant man.
Write music, too.
A brilliant man. His drum solos are unlike anything. When I see people nowadays that say, check out this drum solo. It looks like noise to me.
Yeah.
It's noise. It's just some dude banging on his kit and acting like a fool.
But you listen to Steve Smith from Journey. I mean, you know, wow.
Yeah, it's
you
know? Just, I mean, there's a difference. That's like an orchestrated piece.
He doesn't break a sweat, man.
No.
You know,
I've seen Steve Smith up close and personal at like a clinic, and it's really impressive.
I bet. But you know, when I think of drummers, I try to emulate. You know, I think of people like, you know, the drummer for the Outfield. I could tell you his name. No, you know, John Cougar's drummer.
Kenny
Aronoff.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, he was a beast.
He's a
good drummer too. I mean,
he was very loyal to Mellencamp for all those years, but he was kind of a dark horse in the studio world.
He was
getting a lot of calls and playing as a ghost on a lot of records that people don't know about.
I met Kenny once.
I actually texted for him a few times, and he was a super nice guy. But his history, I think, is a lot deeper than most people realize because there were so many things that he did off the record.
But you think about one of the all-time drum licks that everybody knows.
Oh, of course. Jack and Diane.
Yeah, Jack and Diane. Yeah. I mean, it's nothing fancy.
No.
But just like, you know, but In the Air Tonight.
The way that his drums were tuned and the way that he approached that lick.
I know, it's cool to hear that story.
You can't.
Yeah.
Not everyone can do it.
Yeah.
The same goes for Tom Sawyer. The same goes for In the Air Tonight and Phil Collins. I mean, you just... That's a signature thing.
It's a signature lick.
Yeah.
And but you know, if I was to say, you know, who do you look at when you're trying to emulate someone? He would be one of those guys. Mm-hmm. You know, because he's a good, not all the way through, but
no, just, you know, bits and pieces.
Yeah.
You kind of learn from everybody.
Yeah, you do.
Whether you like it or not, I mean, you can usually discover something in every musician that you see, especially in the drumming world. Like it's
Smith is the king of the one note fill.
Yeah.
You know, and if you watch me, I do a lot of
But that's what it calls for.
Yeah.
If that's what you're playing.
It's nothing fancy, though.
Well, let's get back to
the
notion. Well, this is going to happen. Believe me, this happens with everybody.
Sure.
You get into the field of DJing and radio. Mm-hmm. You get into the radio world by pure luck of who you know, like you said.
Yeah, I put together a decent demo tape.
You did your own way of, you were self-made.
Yeah.
As a radio DJ, and therefore you earned a job in that field. And
I was overnight.
Yeah, you got it.
You know, back in the 80s, there was a time when all radio stations, if you were on the air, you had to have a live person with an FCC license.
Absolutely.
In the building.
Yep.
So I did midnight to six nights a week,
mm-hmm.
for a couple years. And then I was working part time at a TV station too. That's where I met my wife.
So Amy was in television.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So you know, she was the anchor at BKO forever.
Yes. And I could say I met Amy on several occasions because I've performed at WBKO a few times. But I know a lot of the same people that she knows.
Sure.
And
she's
always super nice. And I when I was in like high school.
Yeah.
She was the news anchor at that point. I think either AM Kentucky or
the actual 6 o'clock
news.
And
she kind of did both.
She went and did the evening news. But
so she was kind of a fixture in my household of the news, because I trusted ABC more than anybody.
Yeah, sure. I got you.
They're the most trusted news source.
It's in their slogan.
Well, it would go from Peter Jennings to Amy and Gene, you know, and so I was just used to that. That's what I grew up with.
But we met because of broadcasting.
Okay.
But radio was always my first love, and I stuck with it. And then back in 1999, I have a cousin who was a drummer.
Okay.
And he lives in Clarksville.
So there is some musical
family
connection.
You know, that was part of the reason I wanted to play. I wanted to be like Wayne.
Oh.
You know, Wayne plays drums. He's in a band.
Yeah.
You know,
it's cool.
first time I ever played in a band with anybody, you know, a top 40 band or a cover band or whatever, was his band. And I played Rock and Roll Fantasy by Bad Company. Yeah, you know, it was during their sound check, so it's not like I did it in front of a group of people.
Yeah,
but,
just doing it.
You know, it was cool, and that's when I got the fever.
Literally started playing drums in middle school, high school,
mm-hmm.
but then put it down. You had them?
Didn't even have them.
No, you didn't even have them.
No.
But you at least had sticks or something, right?
I maybe had some sticks here and there, you know.
Just tap on stuff
all
the time?
You know, maybe once every 2 years or so. I would sit in with the band, and
so it was always
Amy,
there.
You know, she like one of her favorite songs is "Give Me Three Steps." I'm like, well, I can hammer out.
Hey, lady, check this out.
You know, it's pretty. It's basic. I
mean,
there's nothing too.
I've played that song a billion times.
So hey, it's good. Come over here and play with you. What do you want to do? You know, it's pre-rates. How about give me three? Yeah. You know, and then you know she's like, ooh,
yeah,
and she's over it now. But been there, done that.
I
got the T-shirt. You know,
she's secretly into it.
But my cousin Wayne. So I went and saw him. He lives in Clarksville, and we were talking, and I said, yeah, one of these days I'd like to get another drum set and pick it back up. He goes, I got one. He goes, I don't play it. And it's the Ludwig that Sleeper Agent uses now.
No way.
Yeah, so it was great. It was a 6-piece kit.
Yeah.
Had a Black Hammer Krone snare, which I still have.
That's nice.
And I mean it was top of line. Everything. And
so after 20 years of just secretly wanting to be a drummer, you actually said, you know what? I'm going to get that drum set, and I'm going to start playing drums.
I'm going to start playing drums.
And that was in what?
That was in 99.
Okay.
Well, let me think here. So it would have been in 2000.
Okay.
Well,
that's a good way to count it.
Because,
a solid 20 years.
Because my wife and I had a deal when we got our first house. It had a garage I could get a drum set. Our first house that we owned didn't have a garage.
Okay.
So we bought this new house in 2000. She was pregnant with my son, who's in college now. Mm-hmm. And and I went over and saw Wayne one day. We was talking to him. He goes, I got one. He goes, I'll sell it to you. And, you know, it's like it was like a $5,000-$6,000 set.
Yeah.
He goes, I'll sell it to you for $1,000. I go, I don't even have $1,000, man. He goes, pay me $100 a month. I said,
so you got a payment plan.
Deal.
Yeah.
You know, symbols, everything.
A, no kidding. I was going to say, yeah. Is it like the whole deal?
And, I mean, Wayne's, he's.
I mean, still go buy bits and pieces, yeah. But you got like a complete set.
I got the whole thing. And I was like, phew. So for a year, I sat that thing up in my garage and I just got my chops back.
Hmm.
And then that's how I kind of hooked up with Skip Bond and the Fugitives.
Yes. Now that would be the band I think a lot of people that know you will associate you with that band. Because
right.
when it came about, it was a big deal.
Yeah.
It was not, I don't know how to describe it because everybody that I knew that was the type, they don't go to Tidballs. They don't go to the bars all the time.
Yeah, your parents.
They don't go to the local bands and the punk bars and all that stuff. But they would still want to go to the concerts in the park.
Right.
They would still want to go to the things at the public events that would have a live band.
Right.
You guys made a really big impression because of the name and who was in the band.
Right.
And it was because of what you all did, which we all, anyone that knows you guys knows that.
Yeah.
You know, but for those who are listening to this that don't know that, you were a state representative.
Right.
In Frankfort.
So well, not when I started with
not
them.
When you started, but you were still.
Yeah, I was still in radio.
Okay.
And then when I decided to run for office, I'll tell this story real quick. When I decided to run for office, that kind of kills the radio career. So then I went into business development for a construction company, and I'm still in construction today. I'm a salesman.
See, I don't know any of this stuff.
So, so I joined Skip Bond, and I'm not the original drummer.
Okay. Who was?
Rick Williams was the original drummer.
Rick Williams was.
And the first time they played concert in the park, they were on they were on a flatbed in the park, and I went and saw them because I had actually seen Tommy Holderfield, the keyboard player, the founder of the band, one of the founders, at the Balloon Classic.
Yes.
And when I was with the radio station, we had...
You were involved with that.
We did the country concerts, and we had Restless Heart. They came back.
I remember that.
It was their first show together in 10 years. It was here in Bowling Green, and Tommy was back there, and we were chitting and chatting, and I said... you know, he goes, got a band now. I said, well, if you ever need a drummer, you know, let me know. I've been working on it for a year.
Right.
Get my chops back. And he goes, well, you come see us Friday night concert at the park. And I went, and it was a train wreck. I mean, it was an absolute train. And anybody that's in the band will tell you that.
Okay.
They didn't have a bass player. They passed the bass around, and nobody could play bass.
Oh, how weird.
You know, so a horn player played bass song or two.
See, I don't know any of that.
Steve Wilson played a bass song or two. another horn player might play the bass. Tommy might play the bass. You know, it was crazy.
Wow.
And so...
But the name came from the idea of what the other guys did.
Yeah, and that came from Doug Gorman.
It did. Okay.
Yeah. So do you know Doug?
I do know Doug. Yeah.
Of course, his brother's Steve Gorman, the drummer for the Black Crows, and Trigger Hippie.
Formerly. Trigger Hippie. Yeah.
He still owns part of the Black Crows.
he's not afraid to talk about it.
No.
And I don't blame him.
So anyhow, he did a nice post on Near Pier, by the way. Doug's the one that came up with the name.
Steve was a judge.
Yeah, probably. You know,
and
it was play on words.
Right.
Skip
the other
the
guys
pages.
Had involvement in like.
Well, no, we had a plastic surgeon, we had a lawyer, an architect, an insurance salesman, and Steve. That was the original man. And
see,
Rick.
For some reason, I'm under the impression everybody was a cop or a firefighter or a lawyer
shit. No,
but it's not that.
No.
Okay.
No. Doug Gorman, it's my understanding, Gorman just came up with the name. Like it was a Rotary band. They formed out a Rotary to do a spoof show or
that's
something.
That's true.
And, you know, their first song they ever played was, I think, Venus by... Not Bananarama, but the original version.
Yeah, no, we'll go with Bananarama. But wait, was Blue Light Special the band?
Blue Light Special was the cop band, yeah.
Okay, that's what I'm confusing it with.
Okay, and I'll get
and
to that.
And the bass player of that band did come.
He came into Disorderly Conduct.
Disorderly Conduct, which was a combination of both.
Yeah.
And we're slowly getting to that.
Yeah, we're getting there. So, you know, Skip Bond had a good run. Yes, you did.
We did a lot of stuff.
I mean, 1 year, I think we did like 40 shows.
And mostly here.
Yeah, mostly here. Yeah. I mean, we do some out-of-town stuff. Yeah. I mean, we've played.
But, I mean, private parties.
Yeah, private
aren't
parties.
Aren't the newspaper.
We're the wedding
your
band.
Your name was out a lot. And, of course, you were the staple of Concert in the Park for a very
We always played the last
time.
Show.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it was a good run. But then, you know, and then eventually some members came in and out. Like Bobby Baldwin joined the band for a while. You know, I was the drummer, and then I kind of left. You know, Steve and Halsey and Hildreth and I, we left and started a band called Match Daddy.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it just like any other band.
Yeah, just,
you know,
things happen,
blah, blah, blah. It's family, you know. Yeah. We're all still friends. And then Halsey died, Tim Halsey, Dr. Halsey. And so that's when, you know, that was sort of the end of Skip Bond. So a few years later, Steve and I have still been together. And, you know, Steve and I are coming up on 20 years being together in a band of some sort.
That's wild.
Yeah. And we came across Tim Wilson, who's with Blue Light Special, and they had broken up.
Excellent bass player.
Yeah, he's
just
good.
Absolutely good fantastic bass player.
So we got him and the guitar player from Blue Light, Denny Lyle, who's a phenomenal guitar player. Not really well known, but.
Just kind of an under the radar kind of.
But man, he can flat down play it.
Yeah.
And he can sing. And so we decided to start a band. We got a keyboard player from Crossland Church, Franklin Williams, and you know, put this band together, and got the old horn players, the second generation of horn players from Skip Bond,
right?
And brought them in, and it's basically Skip Bond but better.
Yeah,
you know, that's
it's
how
just, and that's I think that's how most people thought of it.
Yeah, and
it was
people
just
were
kind
still
of
calling
the
us going,
changed.
Are y'all still Skip Bond? Or,
yeah, the name changed, but it's still some of the
Skip
core
Bond-like.
Guys and the core principles of what that band was founded on.
And so, you know, Tim's not with us anymore. We've got Frank, drawing a blank, you know, Frank from Butler County.
Sure.
And his brother's a guitar
oh,
player.
Oh, Frank Lawrence.
Frank Lawrence.
Yeah, I knew that.
You know, solid. I mean,
oh,
golly.
I've worked with Frank for a long time.
Yeah, Frank's
a great.
Killer.
I think Frank Lawrence made me a better drummer.
I can see that. You know, he's making me better.
Because I was going from my 20s to my 30s, and, you know, I'm working with him and Derek off and on. And I think they helped me become a better drummer on metronome because they're very consistent.
Yeah.
When they play a certain song, it's played a certain way, a certain tempo. And Frank being the amazing professional bass player that he is, I really put a lot of credit toward him, and I may not give him enough credit where it's due. But
he, you know, he's.
I remember now he talked to me one day because we did an out of the blue show. We got the Rolodex call.
Yeah.
I need a drummer. I need a bass player, and it ended up me and Frank. And I remember him telling me that he had gotten the call or the offer to jam with you guys.
Yeah.
I remember that
and
now.
Franklin,
that was a while back.
Frank, it was in the summer.
Yeah.
And then Franklin Wiggins, our keyboard player, he goes to the church that Franklin's a pastor of up in Morgantown, the Crossland Morgantown.
Yeah, yeah.
And he goes, I got the guy. And, you know, what a guy.
Yeah.
I mean, and just a great guy, too. I mean, so he's our new bass player, and you know, we're crushing it. And
you guys are having fun.
We have fun, and that's what it's all about for me. You know, I don't hunt. I don't fish.
Yeah, I can relate to you on that.
You know,
I
play drums. You know, that's my hobby. And, you know, I've played with musicians. I've been on stage. I've been at blues jams before. Not necessarily the Kenny Lee blues jams. But,
yeah, there's random stuff out there, but most people
and I've been with guys that get up there and they give you the dirty look, and you know, if you don't do something they think
it's like,
you know what, Yes.
It's a blues jam, not professional night.
You know, it's not like we're, you know, going to have to feed our families off this gig. So, you know, if I like to play with people that like to have fun.
Yeah.
You know, I'll jam with people if they want to have fun. You know, I'm a cover guy. Mm-hmm. I've never in my life been an original song band.
That's what I was going to ask you, is are these like the core bands you've done?
Yeah, it's all cover stuff.
Because clearly, I mean, coming into this later in the game and acquiring a kit just as we're speaking 20 years ago. I mean, that's what you've done for the course of the last 20 years.
Yeah, just I've been a cover band drummer, and I
Steve
like it.
Wilson
I love it.
Has been involved with just about everything.
Yeah.
You were in Poison Karma for a little bit.
That's our
connection because I left the band. I was in the band for about 9 months, and when
I made it longer than you did.
Yes, you did. Well, Andy decided to leave.
Yeah,
Andrew Stahl, which a lot of people may not. I don't think his name gets brought up enough, but. Andrew Stahl,
left-handed bass player.
Andrew is known as an actor, a very well-respected actor. You've seen him in movies that are probably lined on the walls here at Mellow Mats right now.
The best way to most people remember him is the principal in The Blind Side.
Yeah, as of recently.
Yeah.
But he was like the undercover agent in some movie that he made a lot of.
He was Nathaniel Green in The Patriot.
He was the juror in... What was that movie?
Oh, yeah.
See, I always draw a blank on movie titles.
Yeah, yeah.
But believe me, Andy Stahl.
He's a character
from
actor.
Morgantown. Anyone who knows
him. He's actually from Bowling Green.
Well, he's from Bowling Green, but he's lived in
Butler
County.
He went to College High.
Yes, of course.
And the reason I know this story, because Skip played the College High. It was like an all-class reunion.
Yeah.
And College High closed in like 71 or 72.
That's true.
It was at Western. And Halsey went there. Hildreth went there. Andy Stahl went there. And, of course, you know, Tommy Holderfield, who is our keyboard player, and Steve Wilson and some of the other guys went to Bowling Green High, and they always made fun of the college because College High didn't have a football team. They had a ballet team.
You know?
So Andy was on the ballet team.
Well, Andy was in this band called Poison Karma.
And I jammed with them. I jammed with them once. You let me set in.
Yeah.
And, play once. And I think I played quarter flash or something like that. Something.
Well, Marie and Kevin had built that band.
Yeah.
And it was a really good band. I think the set list was solid, and they had a really good thing going. At the time, the club circuit, there were some clubs that don't exist anymore.
Right.
And they were in the know, and I think their drummer at the time was Kevin's brother, and Rodney.
Yeah, Rodney.
He was kind of like wanting out, and somehow I got wind of it, and they asked me to join, or I auditioned and joined and got the gig. And I sat down after the second or third show with Andy, and I was like, why are you doing this? Because I didn't really make the connection that this guy flies out to Hollywood and makes movies with, you know, Matthew McConaughey, and then he flies back to Bowling Green to play a gig at, you know, Betty's. And I'm like, why are you doing this? And he was like, well, I played bass in high school, and I really missed it, and now I'm 60-something, and I wanted to play again.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay.
Yeah.
We're up there playing Katy Perry songs and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was weird, but it was awesome. We had a really good time. And for the 9 months stint that I was in the band, I think we had a really fun time. And we played a lot. They played a lot.
Yeah.
And that was the one thing I think that kind of wore me out. I was like, I love playing music, but every weekend?
Yeah.
I don't know if I was signing up for that.
You know, I was fired. Yeah, it's the only band I've ever been fired from.
I quit.
Yeah, no, I was fired.
Rodney
wanted to come back.
Rodney wanted to come back.
So, you know, so it's just
the brother wins.
Rodney's
a great drummer.
I'll tell you, though, of all the bands I've been in, their set list was the one I most wanted to play.
It was really fun.
It was so much fun. But the problem for me with that band is that I'd never, ever, not once ever, practice with them.
No, they did not rehearse.
And so, you know,
you learn the CD or you call the radio station and request it to learn the song. I did that with a few of them. Because Maria was like, we do this song by Triumph.
Yeah.
You know? And I was like, I've heard that on the radio my whole life, so I'm going to have to call the radio.
That one, I did that one fine. But, you know, I struggled on Heartbreaker by Ben Attard. Oh, yeah. You know, it's got that weird tempo change in the
exactly
middle.
I know exactly what you're talking
about. And, you know, Kevin kind of look at you like, come on, man, you got this. Yeah. Don't, come on, you know. And I it was a train wreck every time we played it. And, you know, I just, you know.
Somehow I could nail the breakdown in Heartbreaker, but there was some other stuff they did that I didn't care much for it.
And I Love Rock and Roll. I never played it and ever played it before on the drums.
Oh.
And, you know, but I knew it word for word.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But I never listened to it, you know, to the beat. And the beat switches. It flips
does.
On you.
Because it's a drum machine. Yeah. It's a drum machine.
It's, dun, dun, dun,
yeah. It's a drum machine.
And he goes. You know, it skips a beat.
It's a crazy song to play, but it's actually. You can sink your teeth into it.
Yeah, I mean, once the first time we played it in public, I was like, "Well, shit, that was a train wreck too." And then, sorry, I didn't mean to cuss on your show.
No, you can say all the shit you
it's
want.
A podcast.
It doesn't matter. Yeah.
So the next time, I went home and listened. Like, oh, the beat flips.
Yeah.
You know, like all throughout the
I'll
song.
I'll give them this much: they were very consistent with playing the songs to the record. Like,
sure.
They really wanted it as good as possible.
But,
so I did the best I could. But I was in that band for 9 months. And when Andy got tired or whatever, he wanted to leave. I was like, well, I'm not going to stick around. If Andy's gone, it's not going to be.
So I guess Lippert came in. John
Lippert came in. John Lippert came in. I think I did two shows with him. And then they got Melissa.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that.
And then I think you came in after Melissa.
Somewhere in there.
Something like that.
And I was with them for about a year, and I loved the music. But again, they played a lot of gigs. And
didn't really add or change anything.
No,
it was very consistent.
You know,
but it worked. And my problem was you can't play – if people come to see you once, they've seen you 100 times.
Yeah, you got to change up that set list.
And if you do the set list the same songs, the same order – it becomes mundane,
yeah,
and it's a broken record, and that was my argument. So I was like, I'm out. And the one thing about Poison Karma is around the time of me leaving that band, I was driving home from a show. I was fucking furious. I was like, I never again want to play these songs.
Yeah.
And that's the night I got home and decided I'm going to start writing my own songs, and I'm going to record my own songs, and that was the birth of the Captain Dean thing.
Sure.
But I was just livid. I was like, I can't play covers for the rest of my life.
See, I can, and I'm fine with that. But, you know, I'll tell you the thing about Poison Karma. And when we talked, when we were messaging each other today, I said, I want to talk a little bit about the business.
Yes, please.
Of being not being in Nashville business.
No,
being
but
in
music
a,
business.
Being in a band, yeah. You know, being in a garage, bar band, you know, wedding band, whatever. You know, we'd play that freaking VFW place in Muhlenberg County.
The one in Central City?
Yeah. It, once a month, you know, it's $100 a head, if that much. And,
don't
you know,
miss that shit at all.
You come home with a sinus infection because, you
they
know,
still
they,
smoke.
They, you know, your equipment stunk, you know. And I would try, and I talked to, and Chris Carmichael and I had a great conversation about this last fall. You know, there's a lot of bands, and I've had talks with musicians who are really good musicians that don't understand why nobody wants to pay them.
Right. Because times have changed, for one thing.
I disagree, you know, and here's where I get into this is that, you know, Skip Bond or Disorderly Conduct, we're just fun guys. We have a blast.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Wilson's entertaining. He'll keep you in stitches.
And he's
the Gene Simmons
absolutely.
Of bands. He forgets the lyrics to all the songs.
And that's why everyone loved it so much.
But we still get through the songs. We play them. People know them. We have fun. Yada, yada, yada. But, you know, you play these bar gigs, and if the bar is going to pay $50 a head and you accept that, that's on you.
Yeah.
You know, it's okay to say no. You know,
it is, and I learned that.
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay to say no.
I learned through being in that band, I was driving home that night. I was mad. I wanted to start playing originals again, or at least start playing originals. And I said from that moment on, I would rather play for free in front of a room full of people enjoying themselves than to go to Central City, Kentucky to play in front of 5 people watching TV and make $50.
Yeah.
That's where I drew the line.
And
but that's my decision.
That's on you. And it was, but for me at that point, I was super stoked to be playing songs that I've always wanted to play.
But yeah, you were kind of, you didn't do it for 40 years. You got into it later in life.
But I'd already been, done 15 years with Skip Bonded by that point. So, the one thing that I think bands, I don't care where you are, at what stage you are, if someone calls you to ask you to play a gig, shoot high. If it's a wedding, ask for $3,000.
Yeah.
Ask
because
for
it. Because the DJ's going to make two, right?
Well, a lot of people like to have both.
They do, and that I think sometimes they expect the band to be able to plug in an MP3 player or a computer.
And we'll do that for them, but between breaks, if they don't have a DJ, but ask for $4,000 or $5,000.
Yeah,
you can only you start high, you come down low. That's just the basics of negotiating.
It's in the budget.
But we as Disorderly Conduct, each one of us as a member of that band, each member of that band after every gig makes as much per person as you would playing the whole band would play at any bar almost.
Yes.
And so why is that?
But because of the situation and the people that are hiring you.
That's right.
People that have money can hire a band and pay $3,000.
But bars might
be struggling, the one guy that owns the bar might be living in poverty.
I guess, but what I'm getting at is some of the mentality of the musicians are, they think they have to play bars.
I think it depends on what you do and how long you've been doing it and what has happened. And for an example, it happened to me during my stint of doing cover bands. We would play a venue, and I think as a band would make $400.
Yeah.
So $100 a person. Well, out of the blue, about a year or so into this, so and so's booking the bands now. They still will hire you guys, but it won't be monthly. Oh, and the pay's gone down. So now instead of making $100 a show at the same venue I was making $100 a show, now I'm making $75.
Yeah.
And that was like, but you're still getting the same amount of people. We're still bringing the same show. We're still making money for you guys. Why the change? And that's where I started to wake up.
And that's that. And that's where I would say, well, you know what? Last year that was our fee. This year it's $100 more.
Yeah, because inflation.
Yeah, and I've talked with other people in bands about, they've asked me about it. How do you do it? You got to ask for it.
You got to be willing to walk away. It depends on who you're talking to.
Yeah, it does. And
not anybody can afford that, but
no.
People with good jobs or through the loom. Yeah, they're $1 billion company.
But there's no reason why any good band in this town can't be playing those gigs.
I agree.
And, if you're going to go out and just hustle bar gigs, then you're going to get bar gig money.
That's the world you're in, and you choose to be in.
But, for us, on our Facebook page, I post, hey, we're booking for 2020. Call me, for your special event. We do not do any bar gigs. The last bar, the only bar gigs we did the last few years were for Janetta. And occasionally we do 643, and we kind of make them bump up their price and feed us,
And that should be a staple anyway.
You would think.
But yeah, everybody's different, and everybody books different and handles different and all that stuff. But
And I know we got to get going here soon, but I did want to talk about a couple of drummer. You mentioned these earlier. You talked about the Wrecking Crew.
Yeah.
Hal Blaine was main drummer. But, if I were to say, and I talked about Mellencamp's drummer. Golly, man.
It's Kenny Aronoff.
Kenny, I know. I mean, probably the most famous drummer you'd never have heard of is probably the guy that's influenced me the most.
Well, I could name 100 people, but that's going to be strange.
And that's Roger Hawkins.
Okay.
And you know, you think about him, and when I look at him and I think of him,
mm-hmm.
I think that's the guy. I mean, if you think about the songs that I play over the years, the stuff that I play, he's played on a lot of those records. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everything from Mustang Sally
yep.
to old-time rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was the drummer. Yep. He was the Muscle Shoals sound studio.
Yes, he was.
He's the Swamper. And you know, so he is probably my biggest influence.
That's good.
Without you know, knowing it. I know it now.
Yeah.
And in fact,
there's so many people that get into that field of studio work, or like you're saying, like the cover band work and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, they do admire those people.
Yeah,
and that's from just what you're raised on. I think it just.
But you know,
comes
I mean,
out.
He played on Rod Stewart. He played on mm-hmm. a lot of the Traffic albums.
Yeah.
You know, he played on Art Garfunkel. He played on Paul Simon's album,
yes,
Kodachrome. He did Kodachrome. You know,
I know it's amazing how Roger doesn't get as much love as like Steve Gadd.
Yeah,
or you know, there's so many. Names
I said Hal Blaine earlier, but I meant Steve Gadd.
Yeah,
and then you think.
See, when I saw Paul Simon in concert, Steve Gadd was playing drums for him.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was the only one in the crowd going, oh, my God, Steve Gadd.
Yeah. I said Hal Blaine earlier. He's a guitar player. I meant Steve Gadd.
No, Hal Blaine was the drummer for the Wrecking
Crew. That's it.
Yeah.
But Roger Hawkins, and I had the opportunity. I've been to the Muscle Shoals studios a couple of times, but I went back in September. Our congressman, Brett Guthrie, mm-hmm. is from there.
Oh, he's from there?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so he set up a little trip where we went down there. And we went and toured the studios.
That's cool.
And we met with some of the actual studio musicians of the day. And I'm drawing a blank again. We had lunch at this guy's house who was he produced all of Jimmy Buffett's albums.
How wild is that?
He produced all of Dan Fogelberg's albums. He was the studio bass player for Elvis. So he's part of that Muscle Shoals
right.
sound. And drawing a total
it's okay. Blank. It happens to everybody I
yeah.
interview.
But anyhow.
Just call him buddy.
Yeah, my friend. And, you know, we were sitting there talking. Of course, I'm 53 years old. While I haven't played publicly or consistently, you know, my whole life, I've been around music my whole life.
I'd say consistent
yeah.
for 20 years.
But, you know, I thought it was funny because he was talking to me like I was, you know, 15. And, you know. You're the heartbeat of the band, you know, this, that, and the other. And I go, I hear you, man. You've got more gold records than I've ever seen in, you know, one house. And we're in his house.
That's crazy.
And he says, and then he says the magic word to me, you just keep it in the pocket.
Yeah.
I'm like, you know, whenever.
And then to get that compliment from Tyrone
yeah,
brings
know.
It full circle, right?
So, you know, I'm like, hey. But you know, I've heard the pocket before. I mean,
yeah.
my whole life, and people have told me that before. But
it sounds
that,
like that's, this that's magical the, mystery place to go.
You know, the pocket is the quintessential accolade that you could put mm-hmm. on me. You know, if someone comes to me and says, "Jim, man, you're in the pocket,"
yeah,
my nod's
that means
made.
That the
yeah.
the band, the vibe, the feel, the overall
yeah.
thing. Coming off of the music,
it's there.
Is you guiding? You're the canvas.
Yeah.
That's how I've always thought of it.
So,
so when the paint goes on smooth, you're doing your job.
That's it. And but Roger Hawkins, I'll put him down as my most influential.
I like that.
You know, just because of the body of work, and you know, you think about that story, the muscle. You know, thank goodness for the Muscle Shoals
yeah.
documentary to
oh,
tell
yeah.
that story.
That was so cool.
You know,
to watch,
the Wrecking Crew.
Because I didn't know much about it.
The Wrecking Crew was 30 musicians.
Yeah.
The Swampers, man.
Yeah, it was like what
five?
Yeah, I was gonna
know?
Say it's like
and there's
10
only
or left.
One drummer.
Yeah,
and. You know, the work that they did, and then, you know, being able to go, play that song, play
it's
that
just
song.
Another one of those things you where know, it's
everything
the right place at the right time.
Sweet soul music, you know, like I said, to Rod Stewart stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking of a couple of his songs. You know, Kodachrome was one of them I mentioned
yeah.
the other day. But Take a Letter, Maria. You know.
That's good stuff.
Of course, Brooks and Dunn remade that.
Yeah, but I know the original.
But it's a good song. It's a great song. Take a Letter, Maria.
It's great.
You know, he played the drums on it. Yeah. Like, holy cow.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you get to hang out with your heroes and they're actually nice.
And you look at these old pictures. I didn't get to actually hang out with him. He's actually in very ill health. But you look at pictures of drum sets, and you know he was just like all of us other drummers in our house, you know, taking a paper towel and putting duct tape on it to the head to get that perfect sound.
The perfect sound. You got to find it in the room, man.
That's it. So,
well, Jim, you have been, like you said, Skip Bond and the Fugitives was kind of your.
That was my comeback.
Yeah, your comeback. But what a hell of a way to come back into playing drums, or at least pursue it. You did that for so long. So many people in the Bowling Green music scene will know that name.
Sure.
You said something earlier about another band that kind of spawned out.
Yeah, Match Daddy.
Match Daddy. What
so,
was that?
So Match Daddy was Mike Hildreth, who played bass.
Unbelievable bass player.
Phenomenal bass player.
Absolutely. I don't know him personally, but I've got to jam with him a few times at blues jams and stuff.
Very versatile.
I mean, he's such a great bass player.
And, you know, so Hildreth, Dr. Halsey, and me, we broke away and started a group called Match Daddy. And the whole idea behind it was kind of to do stuff we wanted
songs
to do.
Songs that you wanted to play.
You know, so we
not the
we
typical
do,
standard stuff, but things
we were,
of
we were doing
fandom.
Tom Petty, Mumford & Sons, Jack Johnson, you know.
The
I mean,
goods.
You know, just... and people were still hiring us. You know,
we were that's crazy.
You know, it's crazy. I mean, we were all over the place.
Well, how long did that last?
It lasted a couple years.
That's it.
Well, Halsey passed away.
Well, that's true.
And I had broken away from Skip totally, but Halsey and Hildreth and Steve were still flipping back and forth. John Crosby was singing for Skip Bond a little
bit. Yeah.
Frank was playing bass with them some. Frank Lawrence, you know. So they would come and go, and you know, when Halsey passed away, we kind of the four of us kind of, well, the three remaining, and said,
just
know, that's,
let it
that's
be.
Kind of it.
Yeah.
And then Hildreth, you know, kind of just went on, did his own thing, and so we.
Yeah, Mike can be found now. And
yeah, he's doing a lot of blues stuff.
He does the blues stuff, but I'm trying to think of that band that
where he plays the upright.
Yeah,
I know which one you're talking about. And then
is
you know,
Kevin
so
the drummer for that?
I'm not sure.
See, now I'm drawing a blank.
But then that year or so that I was between Match Daddy and Disorderly was when I was with Poison Karma. So I never stopped playing.
Gotcha.
So that Poison Karma
the connection,
filled
then.
The void.
Yeah. And then coming out of that, you
started Disorderly
you started Conduct. Disorderly Conduct.
And
again,
we did.
Yeah,
we did.
Again, this band has been a staple at Concert in the Park, which is, again, a Concert in the Park for Bowling Green has been a very long-going thing. What was this year?
30-something years.
This past year was 30-something?
But I can say I've played Concert in the Park for about 20 years now with three different bands. I played. I may have the record for playing the most Spirits in the Caves with different bands.
That's cool.
Yeah,
see, that,
do
there's two things in this town that have eluded me as a musician. I've never got to play Lost River Cave.
Oh,
I've never got to play on the Capitol Arts stage.
I've
Capitol
done
Arts.
Both.
Well, good for you.
The Lost River Cave is a great place to play.
Yes.
But it's a pain in the ass to
it's
set
a
up.
Pain in the ass to set up, but I mean, at least that little access road's got to be helpful.
Well, but it is, but when we were doing
the
Spirits. Oh, yeah, the nightclub there.
To know who played there.
Sure.
Though, that's what's cool.
I mean,
and
I wish
I've
the Kwanzaa Hut was still
with
here.
Somebody about why is there not a list
there
inside
is.
The museum or whatever at Lost River? Shouldn't there be a list of. Look at all these traveling bands that came through and played.
I've seen a list before. Of course, you know.
I have too, but I don't retain
Jimmy
it.
Jimmy Stewart owned the cave for a while. Buster Stewart. You know,
yeah,
Stewart,
Buster Stewart, yeah.
But his dad owned it and ran it. He's the one that ran the nightclub.
No, man, yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so, you know, when they turned that cave over to the Friends of the Lost River.
Right.
And
but it was a dump at that point.
Yeah, they were refrigerators.
But I know there are stories.
Oh, sure.
Of the bands that were traveling through the area would hear about this magical nightclub venue that was air-conditioned. So no other venue had that at that point. And we're talking about the jazz era.
Yeah.
We're talking about the 30s and the 40s.
The big band, the jazz,
yeah.
All that.
So from my understanding, Ella Fitzgerald has performed at Lost River Cave.
Doris Day.
I'm pretty sure Tommy Dorsey came through with Gene Krupa or Buddy Rich on drums or somebody of that nature had played there.
Well, the reason why is because Bowling Green was sort of the halfway stop between Chicago and New Orleans.
Or Louisville and Nashville.
Or Louisville
and
Nashville.
But yeah, Chicago and New Orleans was the connector.
And you know, like any big band, like when Styx came here or REO came here, it was a routing show.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it was a routing gig back in those days as well. You know, the Kwanzaa Hut here in town, which used to be on the river there at Old Louisville Road, the bridge, there was a hut, a Kwanzaa Hut there.
Oh, yeah, okay.
They used to have wrestling there, but they had a lot of big, you know, they had a lot of big acts come through there. You know, Kenny Lee is he knows a lot of this history.
He does.
And him and I talk about it a lot. You know, of course, Van Meter's got history. The Brennan's Tobacco Barn. I mean,
of course.
You know, there's a lot of
legendary stories that have come out of those places.
Yeah, you know, so there's this area, Bowling Green, has a rich music history going back nearly 100 years. Even further, if you think about Ernest Hogan, who is the father of Ragtime, was from here. There's a historic marker. You got to check this out.
Why do I not know this?
There's a historic marker in front of the L&N Train Depot acknowledging Ernest Hogan, and the marker was donated by Skip Bond and the Fugitives.
That's cool. Now, where is that marker at?
It's right in front of the Train Depot.
It's one of
the state historic markers. You know,
well, good Lord, I'm terrible. I didn't know
that. The father of new grass is from Bowling Green.
Of course.
You know, when I was in the legislature, we made that a reality.
I sent you an email. Do you remember this?
Maybe.
Okay. This is a long time ago, but I sent you an email one day, and I said, why is Scottsville Road not called Sandbush Boulevard?
I don't remember that email, but I probably gave you some.
Make it so.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. You know,
we
made Bowling Green the birthplace of Newgrass. That's the next best thing, you know.
That's very true.
There's a rich history here of music. And
you and I are lucky enough to be a part of it, and it's really cool as fans and performers.
If you did a 23andMe kid on the music history, we'd be like 0.1%, but we're there.
That's the thing.
At least I am.
It's an honor to be a part of it, though.
Sure.
And I, as a fan,
jam with some of these people. You know, jam with Kenny Lee.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he's playing.
It's magical.
You know, or Greg Martin,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, Bill Lloyd, or, you know, whoever.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Carmichael.
I know.
I mean, yeah, he's so much fun to play with.
Oh, he's a blast.
Yeah, you know.
We've worked together on a few things, and I'm just honored.
I forgot my other band I had there for a while.
I knew there was something missing.
I can't remember the name of it, but it was
they were great.
They were awesome.
They were so awesome.
So, oh man, it'll come to
when
me.
When did this fall in? Like, when?
I was in the other band. It was just sort of a for fun band. It was all originals.
Oh, wow. Well, come on.
Brent Travelstead.
Thank you.
So, he wrote all the songs.
Yeah.
They were wacky. Rick Mitchell played bass.
I talked to Rick the other day.
And then,
I was supposed to interview him.
The guitar player was.
I remember this now
because
I think that's
we
how
played
Rick,
Johnettas once.
Yeah, I think that's how Rick Mitchell came on my radar.
Jenny Jake was our guitar player.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
And then occasionally Carmichael come play with
that's
us.
That's cool.
Yeah, you know, and we did some covers, but Brent, you know, God rest his soul too. I've lost three guitar players.
Yes, you
I
have.
Mean, between Bobby, Tim, and Brent. But man, he wrote some of the funniest songs ever. They were intelligent, funny songs. So
you can't beat that.
Yeah, and I can't remember what we called ourselves, but we had a blast.
Well, that the name Travelstead is well known in this area.
Well, sure.
I don't think it gets brought up very much, but there are a lot of musically inclined people with the name Travelstead.
Yeah,
of course, I know Steve for so long. He's an excellent drummer.
Yeah.
He's probably got a great story to tell.
Real estate commercials. He's a realtor, right? No, no, I'm thinking.
No. I know who you're talking about.
But he
there's a lot of travel stuff.
He had the drum set in his storage unit.
Well, before we wrap this up, I appreciate your time and thank you for telling your story and your history of involvement, which
it
is
rambled,
cool.
But
well,
hey.
No, it's part of it. So, before we do wrap this up, though, I want to get your take.
It could be your lowest rating show of all time.
I seriously doubt that. It was probably my episode. The Bowling Green music scene, as you've mentioned, incredible history. I'm glad you mentioned some of those things because even I didn't know about the ragtime thing. I'm going to have to look into that and get some more.
In fact, there was a doctor downtown who made an album doing all the
songs?
The greatest ragtime hits of all time. I don't know what they are. But
by the guy that was from here?
Well, he some of those. And,
oh, that's
he did
so
it
cool.
sort of in tribute to him, but he did it on his own.
That's fun. Really cool.
It was neat sounding.
Well, speaking of all of that, and based on our town's music scene and its history, who are you a fan of? Past or present, and what people around here have influenced you all these years?
Here locally?
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, man. I mentioned Tyrone earlier. I always enjoy listening to his band.
Oh, yeah.
I like Kenny Lee. You know, he's Kenny Lee. You know, Slick Rock was the band that him and Hildreth were
yes.
in back in the 70s
yep.
when Picasso's was open.
Yep.
You know, I've heard all those stories. You know, Mike Hildreth, Mike Clark. I don't know if there's any one band, but there's a group of people
right.
that I truly admire. Chris Carmichael.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy, you know, any time I get a chance to play with them, but also listen to them.
Yeah.
You know. I like Cage the Elephant. You know, it's great knowing that they came from here.
Yep.
You know, I always like the fact that my old drum set that Sleeper Agent uses has been on, the late night shows.
Yeah, that's the trip.
he had Jimmy Lewis reshell it, but,
yeah.
you know, so, you know, Sam Bush, obviously,
mm-hmm.
Gotten to know him over the years. And
yeah, I remember the year that – was it you that were in Frankfurt when he came up to be recognized?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So, you know, we did that and had pictures.
See, I'm pretty sure I sent you the message. Like, I saw that and I was like,
you might have.
We need to rename Scottsville Road Sam Bush Boulevard. Make it so.
So, you know, there's a lot of individuals I like. When you say particular bands, you know, I like Ernie Small.
They don't get mentioned enough. That band has been together for 40 years,
yeah, you know,
I believe.
A long time. And,
yeah.
You know, they do great work, and, mm-hmm. and they're just a good, solid band. I like listening to
mm-hmm.
them.
Ernie's such a wonderful
man. And just a great guy, too.
He's been a part of the Concert in the Park series for a long time.
Yeah. Exit 4, when they were around, I really liked it. It was always funny because Amy would say that was her favorite band. And they put that on their website. Amy Bingham's favorite band, Exit 4. And because they played, you know, a lot of the stuff that you and I would like.
Mm-hmm.
And they play some every now and then. They aren't as active as they used to be.
I was
going to
say, I thought I've seen that name not that long ago.
Yeah, I think they've come back and started playing a few shows here and there.
I remember that band being fairly active.
Yeah, they were active. I remember, you know, one of the first bands I remember when I moved to town was Antietam.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and John used to let me sit in and play drums.
John Gibbons, Derek Lawrence, Donnie Hyatt. Who else was in that band?
Brian. Flying Brian was the bass player from D93.
That's right. That's right. And, the official long-haired guy.
And when I first moved to Bowling Green, my first radio job, when you know I came back from Florida, mm-hmm. I was working down there. Amy and I decided we'd go wherever whoever got a job first. That's where we go.
Oh, that's wild.
And so she got hired at BKO, and I got hired on at the old Rock and Roll Buzzard.
You were at the Buzzard.
Yeah, I was the Nighthawk.
Holy cow. Dude, I like that.
Yeah.
I think I might even have a sticker somewhere.
We played rock and roll all day with Rush Limbaugh stuck in the middle.
Well, when D93 went country and became the Duck, Brian Locke went to a station called the Buzzard.
The Buzzard.
It was very short-lived.
Yeah.
I did not realize you were
I was there. I was on at night.
Dude, it was We all were like,
that was like the best station.
It was awesome. I was kind of surprised that
I'm at the Mecca.
When D93 went back, or when D98 came back as D93, back to the rock format,
yeah,
we were all kind of shocked that the Buzzard didn't survive.
Well, what happened was the Buzzard was owned by the Beaver.
And that's why Brian ended up on the Gator for a while.
Well, no, the Gator was not owned by the Beaver.
It was not.
No, because I ended up at the Gator for a little while.
I know that they all kind of ended up on the Gator.
But the Buzzard was owned by the Beaver, and it was like the day or two after Christmas in 1992, because I just got married that year. We moved here that year. I started there in like September or October. And it was like a day or two after we had our Christmas party. They brought us in one at a time and said, "We're going satellite." I'm like, "Crap." So then I went to GGC, and I worked there twice. Cool. And then I worked down in Nashville some, too.
That's great. What station in Nashville?
WSM.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Both. Home of the Grand Ole Opry.
I worked at both of them, man. I was Hunter James. That was my radio name.
No kidding.
On AM 650 WSM, Castle of the South. And then, 95.5 WSM FM.
That was big.
Yeah, and they were the top. Yeah. They were the
They were. They country. They won the awards. Yeah. But I was a firm listener. When I lived and worked in Nashville, I had to get into country just because I had to learn it. I was playing a lot of it.
Yeah.
I listened to Carl P.
Yeah.
Like, religiously. Yeah. Like, Carl P, I thought, had a great morning show.
In his country days.
Yeah.
So, you know, I see you don't have a KDF sticker on there. But
not on
I remember the old KDF.
Yeah.
But I worked on the AM and FM. I was a floater.
That's cool.
And I was on the air the night that Roy Acuff died.
Oh, are you really?
Yeah.
Wow.
They had two studios for the AM. They had one in hotel.
Yeah, which the is one in the hotel you can winter. Watch when yeah. they have the curtains pulled back.
And then we had one in the park
yep.
in Opryland during the summer.
And that was great.
It was so cool.
I miss those days.
It was so cool.
I loved being, even as a kid, I would walk by and just stare in the window.
Yeah.
Here I am at a theme park with rides, and I'm staring in the window watching radio DJs
there,
just sitting there like, "What, kid? We're just talking about the the weather."
Yeah, used to it.
So. That's really cool.
Yeah, so anyhow, that's I don't know how we got on that, but that's
because it's connected to music.
It's all connected.
I didn't know the Buzzard story.
See, oh yeah, I was
the
at the Buzzard.
Things I'm trying to pull out. Yeah. You know,
it was
cool.
So funny because I was like, what a great station. From 11 to 2, we got to do Rush Limbaugh.
Right. Here's my story about Brian Locke. I would call him.
Oh, we started about Antietam. That's true.
Yeah. That's true.
I actually hired Antietam to play Amy's parents' 35th wedding anniversary,
that's
too.
That's awesome.
So I got to know them. They were one of the first bands I met when I moved here. So I always liked those guys. I've been friends with them ever since.
Well, Brian, I would call him at D98 and request, like, Metallica at, like, 3 in the afternoon. Oh, we can't play that until later. You know, it'd be, like, after, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
We can play Metallica then.
Well, you ever asked
And
that?
Then when the Buzzard came along, the Buzzard would play Metallica at noon. Yeah, they didn't care. And so it was groundbreaking.
We played Get the Lead Out after lunch, though, if you remember.
I don't.
It was very Rush Limbaugh ended at 1, and then Brian would do the Get the Lead Out from like 1 to 2.
I remember that.
It was like a whole hour of Led Zeppelin music.
I remember that.
But you ever asked Brian, what's the Cesare's? I every time I see Brian out and about, and I say, play me some Joe Walsh, man. Because I like Joe Walsh, Walsh been good to me so far.
Well, I wish the Buzzard would make a comeback.
Yeah,
you should.
The Hearst
do
is still
radio.
Floating around here somewhere.
It is on Oliver Street.
Yeah, someone had told me that not too long ago that it's still here, and
it's still here. It still runs. I see it on occasion, but I'm pretty sure whoever owns the Hearst that belonged to the radio station. They live on Oliver Street.
Dan Callahan, I hired at GGC, who's now with the Beaver or Woohoo or whatever they are. He was at the Buzzard. He was Robin Cage. We all had bird names. I was Nighthawk. Flying Brian Locke. And then you had Roadkill Bill in the mornings.
That is awesome.
Bill Hatchett.
Now I'm super glad I got this out of it. See, your connection to this town's music history was definitely worth capturing.
So, thank you. Thanks
thank
for having
you,
me.
Thank you, Jim.
Hey, and thanks for, doing the Sound Atlas. I know you're wrapping it
I'm
up.
I'm on
so
my
to
way
speak,
out.
But But you know,
who's next?
It's a time capsule of
it is.
You know, the people that have been involved in the music scene, and you know, you've captured it, and I appreciate that.
But your story needed to be told, and I'm glad you got to tell it. And I thank you so much for your time. And anytime. Jim DeCesare,
thank you, man.
Have a good night. And we are at Mellow Matt's Music and More. And starting tomorrow, every Whitney Houston record is 10% off.
And all the Rush albums are double.
Yes. Let's not forget that.
Yeah.
Jim, thank you so much again for your time, and we'll see you later.